Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
Now funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination, hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Owl. We have Ricardo on the board, S&P Futures. Down 50 cents. The S&P Futures down 21 as we had a pretty reasonable comeback rally yesterday after the lousy last week. So that's where we are. Do we have to Professor Carl?
You do.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. You know, that was yesterday was number one an inside day.
Yep.
Okay. Number two, it was a bounce right off the 50% fib. From Friday. Very close. Not exact, but very close. From the retrace of the previous dive. And interestingly enough, being an inside day, it didn't quite get to where, you know, I thought it might, and then turn again. That's up about another 50 handles from here on the cash. Right around 55.25 is where that is.
Is that a Fibonacci?
Yeah, those are Fibonacci levels. It's fascinating how often those play as actual turn points. And you better hope this one doesn't, because if we get up around there, I mean, we could fail, you know, here today too, but if we get up there and dive, the probability that this thing winds up way down with the first digit not being a five is pretty high.
I don't disagree. What is your general feeling? It seems like I won't use the word, but I will. I'm going to say you're dabbling in technical analysis. What do you think about technical analysis?
Well, technical analysis is really just kind of a easy way of saying that psychology matters, I think, is the kind of the takeaway from it.
They have all the different patterns.
Right, but it works because people look at it. I mean, that's been my observation. The other thing that's interesting is that since the 08 crash, to a large degree, the computerization of everything and the fact that those algorithms and computers, of course, are so much faster than humans, means that the machine is watching and the machine is front-running these things. There was a fascinating thing that happened a number of years ago. I wrote about it. Actually got an invitation to explain it to some people in Washington, D.C., who saw my YouTube presentation. Also got the CME extremely angry with me for posting it. Over a holiday weekend, I was watching a movie with my computer up. And, of course, the futures, you know, do trade during times when the markets, the cash markets themselves are not open. And I'm sitting there watching this, and the old spoofing pattern that was talked about many years ago was ridiculously evident, okay, in the bid to offer stacks. Now, most of the time, you can't see it because there's so many bids and offers going in at any given point in time that exactly what's going on is kind of hard to suss out. But this idiot was doing it during a time when, everybody was enjoying they're grilling up some stuff for the 4th of July. and I was like, I'm really watching this? So I screen capped it and made a YouTube video out of it.
Well, boy, they didn't like that. It's like, oh, wait a minute. What do you mean? You know, why'd you call us? Well, because you idiots are supposed to be watching this stuff and you didn't immediately go after
it. What makes you think they weren't watching it?
Oh, I thought they were watching it and deliberately
ignoring it. They're watching it and letting it go.
They deliberately were ignoring it, which is what I told them. Yeah. I said, stuff it. You guys are supposed to be the regulators that prevent this kind of crap from going on, and you're deliberately letting it go and hoping nobody else, you know, says anything. Well, guess what? Surprise. I got pretty rude with them on the phone. But the thing is, though, is that part of what's interesting is that over the, you know, the intervening years since that point, you know, more than 10 now, that all of these patterns typically have blown up and have blown up in the upward direction. Okay, so right where you think something like this should work, it all of a sudden doesn't. And the only explanation I have for that, of course, is, you know, we all can see the same pattern, right? I mean, we're all looking at the same stuff. So the computer can see it too, and the computer is faster than you are, and trapping you off sides is, I mean, you know, it is picking up pennies in front of a steamroller, but it works until it doesn't. And, you know, it's a time-honored practice, right? Just try to con somebody else into doing something dumb.
Well, you have people that are allegedly, I mean, there's a, well, where can I start here? You set me off here. I've been somebody who's kind of looked at market dynamics. I'm not like Russell that has written books on it for like a really long time. Even when I was in school, that's all we did, for God's sake, in a lot of the courses at the University of Chicago. And what you see now, to me, is a total abortion of what should be. I mean, when they put the CBOE together, Chicago Board Options Exchange, they did a lot of things differently than the New York Exchange. They separated principal and agent, which now we don't care about.
Right.
We have it separated, but it's even worse because you let the other guy know and you get paid for it.
Right. It's, yeah.
Which is even worse. It's actually double larceny. And right. Several things I've been trading for like a really long time. And trading anything when the real market is, quote, closed is really a dumb thing to do. I mean, I've never traded. I mean, I've had clients who want to get involved in China or Japan or something. I say, okay, if we're going to do that, they're closed while we're trading. So if you want, if you think the Chinese or Japanese market's going to be up 10% on the year, why don't we put some call spread together where we just put it on at our price and one day we'll get filled. And when we do, we just wait until the end of the year. And if we're right, guess what? We make our dough. The typical hockey stick approach, right? The idea of trying to trade something when everybody's asleep is insanity. And it's a massive advantage to the people who are, quote, making those markets. And, oh, by the way, charging you for the commissions at the same time. Because then they'll say, well, we're not charging for commissions. That just means they're taking more on the other end. Anybody who thinks that commissions are free really needs to take a pill.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's one of the things that, when that supposedly happened, I just like, yeah, right, okay. You're telling me that people are performing a task and not getting paid for it.
Good luck on that. Audrey sold his house to these people in a housewarming we get invited over to. And the family is a Greek family, really nice group. And the grandfather, he finds out I was a trader on the floor, all of a sudden I can't, he's right next to me the whole night. And he trades like through Robinhood or someplace. And he goes, I'm trading for free. And I said, well, you're not really trading for free. And he says, what do you mean I'm not trading for free? I said, what business have you been in? He goes, well, I was in the restaurant business or something. I said, who exactly is your customer? He goes, what do you mean? I said, what does your customer do to you? He said, well, he pays me. I said, okay, who pays Robinhood? I don't know. Well, the guys that take the other side of your order. Who's the customer, them or you? He looks at me and he goes, God, I never thought of it that way. I mean, really? I mean, he's a nice guy. It wasn't like I'm trying to give him a whole bunch of crap. But hey, to get back to the technical stuff, I don't know, you probably already know this, but when I was in grad school, the only place in the country, now that a lot of people have, matter of fact, Indiana, where Russell is, has a really good one. University of Chicago had like the only I don't know what they used to call it, the Center for Stock Market Pricing or something. They went back to like the beginning of New York Stock Exchange, and they had essentially categorized every single trade, every uptick, downtick since the thing essentially opened. And you had all this technical analysis with your, you know, double tops and your head and shoulders and double banners and all that stuff. And they went back and did all this research on stock pricing. And they found out that there was a, it wasn't actually, the first story was that it was a random walk, right, from tick to tick, that you could never tell from whether a tick means if stock's trading 100 and the next one's 108th, that's an uptick. If it goes back to 100, it's a downtick.
Right.
Well, a lot of people might not know that. I mean, and today, since it's pennies, it's so blurred you almost can't even tell, right? But anyway, the story was, after all this research, there was a slight mathematical probability positive that if the previous tick was an uptick, the next tick was going to be an uptick. Just a slight possibility, but then the mathematical term, it went from, boy, I'm over my league here, Carl. It went from a, where's Hal when we need him? It went from being a random walk to a, something called a sub-martingale, where, well, I know this is way early in the morning for this, but it was a slightly positive that you could, that there was a tag along tick, but not enough where you could take advantage of it given commissions. Now, the commissions are cheaper, but now then again, people run the markets. There's no standing orders, so I don't know if the other side is anywhere near. So I wonder if you did that again, what you'd find out. But the other point was, they did all this mathematical analysis on technical analysis, and there's. I never learned any of this stuff, Carl. I was only good at the mathematics where there was an answer. You know, the other kinds of mathematics where you just kind of hold stuff, like coloring problems and things like that, I was never very good at. But anyway, they said you could actually, the patterns were there, that you could actually tell that there was a head and shoulders or anything like that. But nowhere in the analysis could you tell when you were in one, to let you know whether you should be a buyer or seller for that minute. But you,
right.
But in arrears, there's no question the patterns appear.
Oh, yeah.
But going forward, there's no mathematical system or how good it is that says you're in the middle of a head and shoulders, so be careful, the next tick is going to be down.
Exactly.
You know,
So
what is that? There's a name for that in mathematics. There's like patterns that shape up, but it's not anything you can predict.
Well, that's one of the problems with, you know, with one of the reasons I don't pay much attention to like the Elliott Wave stuff, is that in hindsight, you could always look at it and say, well, you know, okay, there were three waves of five or, you know, whatever, right? Or five waves of three or, you know, whatever have you. The problem is that at the time you're looking at it, when I'm sitting here looking at the screen and it's, you know, bar's moving up, bar's moving down, this one's green, this one's red, whatever. It's a dice roll as to whether or not it's going to end up being this pattern or that pattern, but I don't have a time machine, so after it forms, I can't go back and change my mind.
Well, that's right,
and so I mean that's and I have, you know, and I have to trade based on, you know, what I have in front of me right now. What I think is fascinating about this entire thing is that this, when, you know, we've talked about the price sales ratios and price earnings ratios and, you know, where the market is. It's by any standard you care to use, it's insanely expensive, okay, from a historical perspective.
I'm going to give you one exception to that. By the way, you know, I agree with you. I'm going to say if from 2008 to today, if I could have made something change in my management of stuff, I still would have done protected stuff, but I'd have been way longer, because we have had a couple of blips where you wanted to be protected and you made money on the downside. But I would have been way, if you would have told me in 2008, being the monetarist that I am, that in my opinion, foolishly or sneakily or however you want to do it, the government was going to routinely, every year, jump the money supply 7.5-8% when growth is 2, I would have just been not only long every stock I could for my clients, I'd have been long extra calls and everything else. Because but I never, even though I kind of saw it happening, Carl, I never believed that they would keep doing it. I just think that I always thought cooler heads would prevail. And I wasn't the only person seeing it. And all of a sudden, people were going to say, wait a minute. Or all of a sudden, you get an explosion in interest rates, which they managed to keep down by buying every bond in front of people and running up their balance sheet to how many trillion dollars. We never saw that in 1975 or 1978. This has been an absolute plot to degrade the dollar.
I would have never, I mean, you could go back and you can look at the stuff that I wrote around the time of the 08 crash, because that's when I started writing my blog. And of course, I've been watching this stuff and trading it for a whole lot longer than that, because being involved with the market is, and paying attention to what it's doing, when you're running a company in a brand new field, which I was, you'd better be paying attention to the macroeconomic picture and the market picture.
Yeah.
Right? Whether you're publicly listed or not, you better be paying attention to it, because all your suppliers are publicly listed. And by the way, if one of them blows up, it's going to have a very bad impact on you. So, that's just part of the job, right? But I never would have believed back in the 08 time frame that there was any way that they would not only do this, but if they tried it, that they'd get away with it.
Well, the 1980 seems like a long time ago, but it's not economically. To forget all that and do it again, worse. This time they had coordination with other governments, though.
I understand that, but even so, I never would have believed that you could pull this kind of a thing off and actually get away with it. Okay, I mean that I just not for this length of time.
Well, the birthday party I went to a couple weeks ago was a gentleman who taught me a lot about options, and he said one of the brightest guys I've ever met, and thankfully he's still very, very healthy and with us at age 80. Those guys, the theorists back, we're talking 1981, 82, and some of these guys were university professors and so forth, and Marty sure as hell could have been. They would scoff at the idea that the governments could get away with trading differently than other people. That it, they absolutely laugh uproariously when governments try to intervene in currency transactions with like $2 billion, and the currency transaction is like 50 a day. It's like, right. Like you and I trying to walk into a big pit and buy a 1,000 lot, and everybody all of a sudden say, "Ooh, those guys, we better go the other way." There was a guy. We'll talk about a floor story, which I don't like to lob out there too much. In the OEX, there was a guy who actually, the story wasn't the best, but the guy ended up committing suicide, right? Big time trader in the CBOE. He was an IBM trader, and then he got huge positions. What the hell was the guy's name? Big huge guy with a bald head. I'll think of his name. Well, the OEX all of a sudden just blew up to where it was the second biggest exchange in the world, the pit I traded in. It did more value than the rest of the CBOE, all the Amex. The only exchange that was bigger was the New York Stock Exchange. And if you traded the market, you traded the OEX. And this guy walked in, and he thought the market was going to go up, and he wanted to buy these calls. He wanted to buy like 2,000 of them, which was...
Yeah.
The thing's trading, 230 or 250. So the calls were not cheap. So he buys 100 from this guy, 100 from that guy. I think I sold him 50 or 100 or something. And the last guy looks at him and goes, I'll do the other 1,000. The guy walks out. They were down an eighth when he walked out. The look on his face was like, wait a minute. I just bought 3,000 of these calls before I could get my behind out of the place. I'm down on the trade.
Right.
But he didn't scare anybody. I mean, everybody did their spoos. There was all kinds of other calls available. I sold those to him, and I bought 150 of something else, like from the guy next to me who was a broker and had an order, and I was fine. I think I made some dough on it because I actually got longer by buying these other things. But it was the idea that people can. But I never dreamed that a government who seems to be so dysfunctional in a lot of ways could pull this off for like 15 years, and they're still doing it.
It's like I said. I mean, you can go back and you can look at the stuff that I wrote at the time of the blow up and what they were doing at the time. In hanky panky's, one page bill, give me $700 billion, do whatever I want. And then that gets rejected. Then they come back with this monster. And you know, it, oh my God, the word, there's going to be tanks in the streets if you don't do this. You know, literally tanks in the streets. We're going to actually have to shoot Americans because there's going to be a revolution. We're like right now. You cannot let Goldman Sachs fail. That cannot happen. You know, Bank of America.
But Lehman was okay. Bear Stearns was okay.
Yeah, it was okay that Bear Stearns blew up, and Cramer saying, well, you know, the Bear Stearns was not going to blow up, and then 3 days later it does.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, that didn't really matter because nobody actually had any deposits there. That's what I said. No,
it's
not what you said. I heard it.
You know the weird part of that? One of the weird parts for me, we had still have a client, big guy. Doesn't work much with me. Works with my brother Dan a lot. And they're actually pretty good, they're good buddies and so forth. And the guy, nine months before the fiasco at Bear Stearns, this guy was involved in one of these off-balance sheet deals at Bear Stearns. You know,
yeah,
I'm going to say not seven figures, but high sixes. And he's telling my brother, you know, this thing just blew up. And Dan's telling me about it. And I go, well, it just never even crossed my mind that somehow Bear Stearns, and I don't know, this guy really didn't know it either. He thought it was kind of separate. But Bear Stearns had all these things off balance sheet, sort of like Enron, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'd have thought about it, I'd have said, wait a minute.
What?
what is going on there? I mean, and it was a mortgage deal, some kind of a mortgage deal. And the thing went under, and all of a sudden the guy had nothing. I mean, he's got a lot of money, but still, I'm sitting there going, and Dan's not a prying guy, and I'm not either from our clients. I mean, we do what they want us to do. It's not up to me to ask them about everything else they're doing and who they're doing it with. I mean, that gets old. You can't do that to people. Not,
right.
And plus, you know, I want to know what they want me to do for them here in a lot of ways, you know.
Right.
And, if they're buying 15 two-flats, I don't know that. I guess if we had a beer and talked about it, cause I like that part of the business, and I'd love to hear about it, but it's only if they want to. You know, it's not like I'm going to pry. Anyway, but there's one. Boy, if I had that one back again, I'd say, wait a minute, what the hell's going on? Should I just short this place? I mean, that would never dawn
on
you.
Well, that was one of the things that, you know, got a whole bunch of people paying attention to what I was saying, was that at the time there were a bunch of basically bulletin boards on Yahoo. And I popped up on one of them, and people were talking about how Mozilla was going to take over the world with Countrywide. And I popped up on there and said, by the way, I'm short in size on this guy because this clown's going to blow up. And needless to say, that oh boy, did the guffaws start with that, right?
Carl, this is maybe we're going to have, who knows what we're going to be able to talk about on Friday, but we only have a few minutes here. But I think everybody needs a little bit of review, not the whole hour on Friday, because I'm sure we'll have all kinds of other stuff, but a little bit of review on just what the size these people were undertaking. When I say that, I'm not talking about trading. I'm talking about some of these credit default swaps. If anybody doesn't know what those are, if you're a economic theorist, which I am sort of half-assed, if somebody buys a bond in Italy, okay, and they're going to get 8% interest when the interest is here is 5. It should lead you to believe that the risk in Italy is higher than here. So if you turn to Carl and you say, Carl, guess what? I'm going to buy insurance from you that Italy won't go under. Well, to me, the price of that insurance really should be 3%, right? You shouldn't be able to gain on the deal, correct? I mean, if you actually go through the economic theory of it, why would it be cheaper than the 3% the market's already said is riskier in Italy, right?
Yeah, well, that's exactly.
Well,
yeah.
But obviously it wasn't. Goldman Sachs and these guys are selling it to people at 1%, right? That's why people were doing it. So
right.
So you say to yourself, okay, now why does Goldman Sachs think that they're smarter than the market? And by the other, and plus, if Italy does go under, do they have the money to pay all this off?
That's the other problem, is if the other guy can't pay you, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that was the thing that, you know, you start looking at this and you go, well, wait a minute. I win and he's broke.
Yeah.
That's nice. But I mean, what I see now is just it's tulip mania in spades.
Sure it is.
Okay? That there is no way that any of this stuff will ever fail. All the monetarist games, all the nonsense in the Congress, you know, none of this stuff will, it's never going to come to a head. It's never going to force a reckoning with reality. It's never going to happen. And boy, there are, something I have learned in my years is that there are two words you will essentially, I don't use. And those are always and never.
Yep.
Okay. I highly improbable. Yeah, you'll hear me say that a lot.
It leaves you with that slippery one, usually.
Yeah, usually, or, you know, or likely, very likely, but always and never. Oh boy, are those bad words? Those words, when they come out of your mouth.
Oh yeah, Ricardo, do us a favor. Write down what we're talking about here, because I think two things are somewhat different, Carl. And this is what I think we have to tee up on Friday. If it really is the salve, or if it's just something that pushes it off every day. I mean, we don't. I mean, I kind of wish we would, but we're not. We've never been involved, never been big enough to get involved in that. You know, we're the 401k people for General Motors or some crap. You know, which would be nice to be. But what do you suppose the general drop into the market is every week or 2 weeks in people's 401k? I mean, if you're Vanguard or somebody and you have a bazillion of these 401ks, I got to believe that the money that drops on your desk every Friday or every other Friday that you have to put in the market, you could think that Google's got to pay a big fine in Europe, and Apple's got to pay what, $14 billion in back taxes. It doesn't matter to you. The thing lands on your desk. Your job is to buy.
Right. And the end of the month ones are, I mean, you know, you can see the impact of those.
Well, and then on top of that, you have this constant dribble of 2-3% money supply over growth. So the combination of those two things means that every time the market has any kind of correction, it will try and right itself until. But the until has been a long time.
Well, exactly. And that's, I mean, you know, that's the old saw, which is absolutely correct, is 80% of the time the market goes up.
Well, for my clients, full disclosure, once we realized a few years ago that this is something that is not just an aberration, they're going to keep doing it, we've really cut back on the selling the calls. We still have the protection, but we've pretty much made as much or more than the market on the way up in the last year or two for clients, and which we never would have done 10 years ago because we'd have been selling calls to cover the puts. So right. we've had to adjust our stuff because this is different. We're still ready if it wants to go down. We still got puts, but. We've had to adjust. I mean, you can't just. Look at the moves in the queues. This thing will move 2-3% a day to the upside, and you're like,
it's
insanity.
It is, but you know what? It goes on until it doesn't.
Well, but it's been a while. Kyle, we'll pick this up on Friday, if not sooner. Take care of yourself. Debate tonight. Is it a trade? Well, it'll be a trading experience or not? Certainly not before.
I don't think it's a trading experience. I don't think anybody's going to hear anything that they don't already know. My expectation is that at this point Harris has basically lost the race, and it certainly didn't help that we now have video all over the internet of Haitians, of which a year ago she was saying, well, we absolutely have to let 100,000 of those people into the United States. They're cooking people's cats in Ohio.
Well, I've had it with this Trump being Ditka. Everything bad he's going to take care of. The guy who was already in there 4 years didn't do anything.
Well, yes, right, and now you have had a Democrat in power for 4 years with her, not just any Democrat, her as part of the administration.
You hear Nikki Haley say that I can't believe what we dealt with, but we got to pick one or the other or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, so.
All right, we'll talk more about it Friday after they talk. Yeah. SP Futures flat, NASDAQ Futures down 20. Quick break, and we'll have Mr. Joel on count.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains. Think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, everybody. Stocks and jocks. Time out, Ricky on the board. We went a little over there, so S&P futures up 75 cents, NASDAQ futures down 18. We're going right to Joel. Joel, how are you, buddy? Doing all right. I can barely hear you.
Sorry, man. Give me one second. There
really?
You go. We're good. We're good.
There you are. Now we're good.
Okay. All right.
What's
no
up?
No technical difficulty Tuesday.
No,
You never introduced me to the new guy.
Oh, Ricardo. He's terrific.
Nice to meet
Ricardo,
you, Joel.
How
you doing? I'm doing good. How you doing, man?
Good. Are you a native Chicagoan?
I am not a native Chicagoan. I'm from Guatemala, actually.
Oh, okay. How's it working with the chief? Does he display any of that trading floor temper at all?
No, actually. Not at all. He's a very nice man, man. He's very nice working for him, for real.
Ricardo is one of the nicest guys. He's on time. He loves listening. He's learning. He's going to school. Got like two or three jobs. He's got doing work on another radio station as well. And one of these days, he might be Senator Ricardo, I hope.
Good to hear. All right, nice to meet you, Chief.
Nice.
So
what do you want to talk about, Chief?
Well, we can't talk about our football teams.
We have to, Chief. That's part of being in the business.
You know, I come away from the Notre Dame fiasco. I love this coach at Northern Illinois.
I know. I'm sure it's common knowledge. You guys paid them $1.4 million to play there or something. You know, the big schools do that. Did they get kicked in the face? But I want us, just Chief, just tell me that I wasn't super pro rah-rah Michigan. That I encouraged people to lay the points. Do you remember?
Yes, you were not all that bullish on a big win.
I wasn't bullish on a win, period. In fact, I laid out the game for Lisa. I told her exactly what needed to happen, and it didn't happen. They needed to get pressure on Ewers. I said, if they don't get at least two sacks on him, we're toast. He's going to pick us apart, and we only had one sack. So,
what do you make of Kevin and I have been kicking this around all weekend. We talked for about an hour. I don't want to go into my Chip Hilton sports stories when I was a kid. They all showed up at State, and they found out all the other people at State had backers, and none of them could break into the lineup because the backers influenced the coach. Do you think the Irish can sit this kid, paying him that kind of money?
Oh, boy. What state are you referring to?
Well, no, I'm saying in the book it was a fictional state. They went.
Okay.
It was a fictional college. But essentially, these kids, you know, Chip Hilton and his gang were better than the guys who were there. Didn't have backers. They weren't on the thing. They ended up playing for like a dorm team. This is 60 years ago. The guy wrote this book. I'm wondering if the same thing's happening today. I mean, you look at the Irish two games. I don't know. If there's any coach in the world doesn't sit that quarterback, and yet he's playing. Somebody's paying him $1 million. Now, how much is the $1 million influencing the coach?
Chief, I didn't know that story, and you know what my answer is going to be. It's all about the money.
Yep, it's all about the Benjamins.
it's all and it is, and you know, you just, I mean, that's just the way it is. This way it's college, this way it's pro. I mean, college is becoming pro, well, right?
It's there.
Expand, yep, it's there. You know, you can argue, well, kids get paid, they, you know, they get an education and whatnot, but as much as I harbor a little ill feelings toward Harbaugh right now, for leaving the cupboard so bare and locked up and some other things that I won't go into, he saw this coming. He definitely, and he saw that, you know, the transfer portal, you know, the social media, the promoting of athletes, the transformation of the game. And that's why, you know, Michigan was able to achieve, you know, they kind of got ahead of it. Now they're kind of behind in paying the NIL money, but everyone else is caught
up. Joel, how many people transferred out because he left?
Well, about three or four.
Oh, so not like 20 or anything like that.
No, no. But one of them was who we could have really used, Keon Sab, went to Bama for a mil. You know, just a mil. I mean, that's, you know, what's a mil? And he had two interceptions the first game. Now, if you told me Michigan couldn't have used another, you know, defensive back there yesterday. Also, you had, he transferred out. Also, our star, one of our stars in the championship game, Rod Moore, tore his ACL in spring ball. And then we lost our entire offensive line. You know, a couple linebackers, but you know what? You can't cry over spilt milk. This is the way it is. I was cautiously optimistic about, you know, 9-3, 8-4. But with the gauntlet of games they have, well, they have Arkansas State. Hopefully they don't pull an Appalachian State.
Yeah, or Northern Illinois.
Yeah, and then they got USC at home.
How'd they ever get that game? How'd they ever get that game as an out-of-conference game?
Because it's not out-of-conference, Chief.
Well, I guess it isn't. Well, I thought they didn't join them next year. Or is it this year?
No. It's this year, Chief.
Ah.
Yeah.
I thought it was next year.
Yeah, and my dad is rolling over in his grave that the Pac-10 and the Big Ten are part of each other.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, and what's it about? What's it about?
You think you're gonna end up with the reformation of the Pac-10 for all the other sports?
You know what you're gonna end up with is you're gonna end up with like four super conferences, and I don't know how it's gonna line up and who's gonna merge.
But are you gonna be sending your girls and guys volleyball team from LA to New Jersey?
That's very economical, Chief. And the underwater basket weaving team. Yeah, we're gonna be sending them to Oregon, maybe do a home and home.
Well, you know, for the sportsters in the world, which you and I certainly are, unfortunately, we're just the way we are, and it's probably not a great thing. But I was mentioning to people, you know, over an adult beverage, the guys were talking about how Southern Cal and UCLA absolutely had to join the Big Ten because they get, you know, $20 million more in TV rights. And I go, do any of you Jamokes have any idea what the budget is at UCLA? And look at me like, why does that make a difference? I mean, I go, just answer the question. And they go, I don't know, I have no idea. I say, you know, it's $11.2 billion. If you and I had a $20 million project, do we even get in a board meeting? You're gonna rip apart your entire athletic system for all the other people for that $20 million bucks?
Yeah, but it's the new contracts coming up. I mean, I don't know the particulars of it. But it's, I mean, you know, now when they show those Big Ten commercials, you know, they show all the different schools and then they go over, you know, they start on the West Coast and then they go to the East Coast. But, you know, I'll just say that, my overall enthusiasm for, college football, I mean, you know, besides Michigan and, you know, the off year we have, it's just different. You know, it's just Oklahoma. Where's Oklahoma, Nebraska? You know, I mean,
Nebraska won last week, didn't they? They beat somebody.
Oh, Nebraska's good. You know, they got a new Dylan Raiola, Dominic Raiola's kid. is their quarterback. And then they got that guy that got kicked around in the NFL as a coach. Nebraska's on the upswing. You know, USC, you know, they're up and down. Now we got Oregon. Do you know Michigan has Oregon, Washington, USC, Penn State. We had Texas. I mean, just a brutal schedule with an inexperienced team. So,
the Irish got beat. I mean, the thing is, it's this thing with Northern Illinois. This was not, watch that game. It was not obvious which was the better team. They got beat, offense, defense, and special teams. They got totally outcoached. I go back to my college days, and and these kids, they probably weren't a student maybe that I was, but it's somewhat of a full-time job. And if you're doing practice 2-3 hours a day and in the morning, you're busy. And now they've got agents to deal with, which they're probably talking to the agent 2-3 times. Are these kids even thinking about football? Are they even thinking about class? I mean, what is going on? How does these 19-year-olds spend their mental time during the day with all this going on?
How many of these guys are finishing school now? I mean, I don't even know what the graduation. I mean, they used to talk about the graduation rates. I mean, now let's just talk about what tax bracket they're going to be.
Some of the open items. I mean, we got a dash here in a minute, but the guy was talking about how this quarterback is a big, his big sponsor, I guess, is Dick Sports. I don't know, maybe he must have somebody else too, but. And how he brought the offensive line over, and they all got all this stuff and everything, and that's how you treat your offensive line. I'm going, are these gifts? Are these income? Is he paying income tax? If he better be careful if he's paying income tax on $1 million that he's not giving $400,000 away, and he can't even count it as a deduction. I mean, do these kids even know what the hell they're in?
No, they don't. But Chief, listen,
you gotta go.
I'm out. I'm out next week.
All right.
I'm sending an email right now to you. I don't have Ricardo's email, but I'm sending it to both you guys. And then, so that will be, I'll be out the 17th. When we come back the 24th, that will be after the USC game. So hopefully I'll be in a little bit better mood. And we'll talk about pro football, right?
Yeah.
Williams, the Motor City Kitties.
Justin Fields won.
Let's talk about that then, okay, Chief?
Yeah, Justin Fields won for Pittsburgh.
And so I'm a pro guy. Didn't you know I'm a pro guy?
Well, I'm going to do something. I might become a soccer guy. Nah, I won't do that. Let's be futures up 2, Nancy Futures down 10. Want to go right to Kenny?
Yeah. We do.
What's up, buddy? How are you?
I'm good. How are you? I'm in New York City today, this week, actually. So it's good.
You make Marco Polo look like a local boy. Boston, New York. Did you stop at Pulcherry's Pizza when you were in Boston?
No, I did not. I did not. I didn't get a chance, so I had to just go up and down real quick, up and back real quick. So I didn't get a chance to go back to Pizzeria Regina or Pulcherry's Coffee House. I did not, but I will the next time.
Well, good for you. How's New York?
New York is good. The weather's beautiful today. It's a gorgeous sunny day, typical kind of mid-September weather, so it's perfect.
Yeah, the fall is nice, isn't it?
Yeah, although I'll tell you, it's overrun. I went down, I took the subway downtown today because it's just quicker than trying to fight the traffic and everything. The subways are just jam-packed with illegal immigrants. They're everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. The city is just overloaded.
You mean, living there or driving?
We're just trying to use the subway system. I mean, it's amazing to me that I walked down and I went, oh, my God, I felt like I was almost in a foreign country because everybody on the platform was, you could tell. I mean, you could just tell, right? They weren't doing anything bad, but it was just the Grand Central Station platform was absolutely packed. I was going downtown, so this group was going downtown. I don't know, not sure where they were going, but I'm just saying, when I walked down there, it's amazing to me that the demographic of everyone on the platform, it was really amazing to me.
Well, that is weird. I mean, if everybody's going to work, I guess it's a good thing.
I don't know if they're going to work. I can't imagine, they're going to work. Maybe they are, but it was just the whole platform was nothing but immigrants, and you could just tell. I mean, you could just tell. And they were going downtown somewhere. And I know downtown there's a bunch of hotels that that the city has taken over to use to house for immigrants down around Wall Street. There's a 55-story Hilton Hotel. I think it's costing the city something like $100,000 a day to house these immigrants. In this hotel, because they've taken it completely over.
Well, the little enclave that's by me, You'd see everybody like outside, never anybody boozing or anything like that. And all of a sudden, yeah, in the morning when I drive by, I see groups of two and three walking to the bus. I think a lot of them are at work.
Yeah, I mean, listen, God bless them if they're going to work. It was just when I walked down into the platform, I have to tell you, like, because I haven't been here in a while, right? Before I used to ride the subway every day, right, when I lived here. But now I don't. So when I walked down into the subway, I noticed the demographic has completely changed. Now, it was early. It was also, you know, 6:45 in the morning. I don't know what it's like at 8 or 8:30. I'll find out once I leave where I'm at. I'll take the subway back uptown just because, again, it's easier. But I'll get a sense of what it looks like, you know, later on in the morning.
Yeah, it's a weird, you know, I don't know. I wonder what it was like this when the Irish and the Italians showed up or whatever. But in Chicago,
in 1910.
I mean, the world was a different, ugly place, probably. But I mean, in Chicago, you don't want to be overwhelmed by anything,
right?
But in the city's so screwed up they can't do anything right. But
right.
I mean, we're losing 80,000 people a year. I mean, if people want to come here and form a community and live here and learn the language and get a job, there's not a whole lot. I'm not saying the entire country of Venezuela. I would never say that. But with the people that are here, certainly the 100 people that are in a spot by me, could we find a spot for them? Certainly, there's areas in the city that are so open, Kenny, it's scary. I mean,
yeah, there's no doubt. I'm not saying it like I think there's anything horrendous about it, because it wasn't like they were down there causing trouble. It wasn't like they were down there throwing people onto the subway tracks. I'm just making a statement that the demographic of the people on the platform was completely, it was just completely changed from how I remember it over the last 40 years that I was here. You know, I've been gone for 6 years, and a lot's happened in the last 6 years.
Well, a lot of people are at home and have moved and all that stuff, too.
Correct. A lot of people are working remotely. A lot of people, by the way, have left the city as well.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons. Because it's too expensive. The taxes are too high. They found other places to go during COVID. They like kind of where they live. They don't mind being out of the city. It was just an interesting view for me.
Well, the downtown here, there's so many buildings that maybe are still 60% rented, but 20% occupied. I look at my firm, and every time we have a client that comes in, we have a client come in this morning, a new client, and it's all three of us that are involved in the day-to-day trading stuff, and the person who does the back office, all four of us. We've been preparing for this lady's account and what we're going to do with it. I don't want to be calling people at home and finding her out walking their dog or something. When it's a client involved, I want everybody here to let's talk about it. And today, when she comes in, a couple of us are going to sit down and spend an hour and a half. This whole idea of the people I see working from home, working for the exchanges, working for the Fed, working for us, and they're at home. I mean, I couldn't possibly have a trading operation where every trade we talk about, where people are home, and I can't find them. I can't do that.
100%. I agree with you 100%. And actually, I got to be honest with you too. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's, you know, my generation. But I don't understand why there's a whole young generation that, you know, during COVID, everyone had to work remote, blah blah blah. But these kids, now that everything's back to normal, they do not want to come back to an office. They don't want to come to the city. They don't want to be, you know, because remember, that's where we really built our careers, right?
Right?
In the office, meeting the older guys, learning from them, mentoring with them, right? And today they're not interested. I think it's a huge mistake. But
they have it all figured out, Kenny.
Yeah,
they absolutely have it all figured out.
You know,
I mean, I can't imagine if I wasn't at Pullman talking to people all day long. That's where all the stuff that people think, how the hell did that guy learn that stuff? But they got their phone. They got their stuff and are ready to roll. And when was the last time they had a conversation with anybody?
Right. Right. But, you know, having a phone and on a Zoom is very different from me walking into your office, asking if you have 10 minutes, asking you questions, explaining stuff to me, having even lunch or a cup of coffee with you is very different than sitting on a Zoom and asking you those same questions. It's just different.
I have a buddy who's having, a lot of people that has a psychiatrist, right, or a psychiatrist, whatever they call themselves, psychiatrist, psychologist, one of the two.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's on, you know, one of these medication things, and you got to be careful when you're on that, because, you know, all you do is blip it one way or the other.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, kind of acted a little strange. And I said, you know, have you seen your guy lately? You sure your stuff is okay? The guy Zoom called. He's on a Zoom thing. And I'm thinking, I mentioned the other day, the lady who used to be on the show and unfortunately had a traffic thing this year, her brother was going to med school. And he said, you know, an old-time doctor, and, you know, not that you have to be old to do this, because when you walk into his office, he's staring at you the whole time.
Right.
You can tell by your walk, by how you sit, by your color of your face, your eyes. He can tell whether you're sick or not. You don't have time.
100%.
Yeah, how the hell do you do that on a Zoom call?
I don't know how you do it on a Zoom call. I'm not sure you can do it on a Zoom call, but, you know, it seems to be the way the world is moving, which is kind of amazing to me, because what I miss the most is I miss the human interaction.
Oh, me too.
I miss, you know, going to the office and talking to you, and let's go out and grab lunch, or let's go out. You know what I mean? That's what I miss.
Well, I mean, we come home from school. I'm sure you did the same thing. First thing you did is get your ass out of the house, find somebody to play ball before your mom dreamed up stuff for you to do.
Exactly.
I mean, the idea of coming home and watching TV, what I want to do home. What time's dinner? I'll be back.
Right. Exactly. I mean, we used to go out in the morning and we'd be gone all day.
There were
no cell phones. No one was checking on you. We weren't getting in trouble. We'd be gone all day. We'd come home at 5 o'clock and, you know, dinner would be on the table. You'd wash your hands and do your thing.
And we had the bounce. Carl thought yesterday's bounce was not bouncy enough to make up for last week. We were having the debate last night. My brother and the other guy, Larry, who helps me with this stuff, were saying, how do you grade this bounce on a scale of A to F? And they're like, maybe a C? it was a bounce, but not... Not the best.
Yeah, it was a bounce. I think it was a bounce from, you know, what was it, kind of a short-term oversold position from last week where the markets got really nervous. I think there was some stuff that was clearly presenting itself as an opportunity, but I'm not necessarily sure that this is over yet, right? We're still in that September-October kind of volatile, seasonally weak time frame. I'm still expecting that we're going to test the August 5th lows, which was like 51.20 or 51.16. I wouldn't be surprised. I actually would like to see us retest it to see if it holds there and kind of shake the branches a little bit more. I would like to see that happen. And I think there's the potential to see that happen over the next 6 or 7 weeks as we make it through the end of September and into October.
Well, I'm kind of concerned. I think the president thing is still a toss-up. I guess maybe we'll learn a little more tonight. But
100%.
I'm not all that happy that Trump's new biggest advisor is Elon Musk. But that seems to be happening. And he was out yesterday with this Bitcoin is a bomb ready to go off and other kinds of stuff. And by the way, I happen to agree with him on that. If that thing were to collapse some, if there was ever a blip there, there's a lot of money there.
If
the Bitcoin stuff were to...
Oh, Bitcoin. Yeah, Bitcoin.
Because, I mean, not only that, that's a significant part of NVIDIA's business, right? Is selling stuff to mine Bitcoin.
Yep.
That could be a domino. I mean, things are this high, you got to look around for your clients and say, okay, what could possibly go wrong? Because that's my job, is to look for the pitfalls because they're working, right? I mean, I'm managing their stuff. But the stuff is just so incredibly high, Kenny, that it didn't seem like nothing going forward because Musk was going crazy about the national debt. Well, you know, national debt is getting to be an incredibly horrible situation.
Yep.
We're up to, like, what, $2 billion a day in interest or some number?
I think it's three. I read yesterday, I thought it was closer to $3 billion a day in just interest payments. And so if rates come down, they said, you know, if rates come down, then it'll go from $3 billion to $2.5 billion of interest a day.
But they're violently against raising any taxes. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and they want every tax dodge they possibly can have. I'm not saying you can tax your way out of this. Don't get me into the tax group here. But I mean, clearly some stuff has to happen in the tax area. Even if you plug a few loopholes, which I know it's not that much dough, but it's moving in the right direction. But I also think that, you know, there's some of the spending has to. But where do you cut spending? Most of the spending goes to people.
Well, that's right. But I think that's the whole argument about Elon Musk, is that they were going to do an audit of all the different government agencies. Because you and I can only imagine the amount of waste in what the government spends. Come on, let's be honest, right?
That was like. There's a story. I went to a a local thing here. And remember the name, how was the guy's name? He was the chairman of the Cook County Board, then he died, Stroger, and his kid took over. I went to this thing, and the kid gives a long speech about zero-based budgeting. That kid, yeah. he knew less about zero-based budgeting than he did about nuclear physics. And yet, you honestly think the money the government spends internally,
yeah,
we all think is you know, it's horrible, right? And you and I would love to do an audit of this committee, that committee. McKinney, the big dough, the big hole. If you look at all this money, and I think you probably know this, you know, because Carl's always talking about it, the massive hole in government is in the Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah, I agree.
So if you're going to do anything, if you and I could be the co-goofballs in the Oval Office tomorrow, the first thing we would do is we'd go after these drug companies and hospitals. And there's no way that anybody's going to want that to happen. That's all the dough is.
Right, but I think there's a lot of dough, too, in defense, right? In the military and defense. I think the government pays ridiculous prices for you know, parts and parts.
It's not, I mean...
Social Security are absolutely wasteful. There's no doubt about it.
I mean, we're paying, and the weird part is, what the government doesn't get is the prices they pay for like Medicare and stuff is way less than other people are paying.
Right.
I mean, there's no way, Kenny, we can have the fatso drug costing them 5 hours to make and people paying and people are paying a grand for it.
Right.
Whether the government can handle it, we can't.
Right.
The insurance companies can't. The companies like PTI that are paying for insurance every month, we can't. I mean, what does Carl say? The Medicare and Medicaid are only paying 40% of the nut. Where Social Security is paying like 90% of the nut. So you and I could fix Social Security in a day.
Right.
Add another year into retirement and kick the rate up by 0.2%, and it's done.
Right.
But this medical side is a big difference.
What do you realize that like a Keytruda or an Opdivo treatment, which is that new immunotherapy, that cancer therapy, do you realize that's a $99,000 bill every time you have it, right? So if you have to have it for 12 months in a row, that's a $1.2 million bill.
Now, if
for somebody that needs that treatment.
Now, if to get that treatment, we had to send Ricardo, who we like a lot, down to the Amazon, and he's got to wrestle an alligator and pull out his wisdom tooth to get the product that's in there.
Right.
I can understand that. If it costs them a grand to make, I got a problem with it.
100%. And so it's interesting because I don't know what it costs them to make, and I get it. They have the whole research and development argument, and it costs them money to do.
You know what, Kenny? That's bull. It's going in their pie. That research and development. You and I are paying for a lot of that. They're not.
100%. I agree with you, which is why I agree with you that that's going to be the first place you look. It doesn't mean you're going to cut Medicaid or health benefits. It means you're just going to audit the system and figure out who's stealing all the money.
You might have to blow up the patent laws. And if we did tomorrow, everybody would think that's a horrendous thing to do, Kenny. If we blew up the patent laws tomorrow, it would be a positive thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, we got off. What do you think? Debate tonight? Trade? How do you trade it before? Is it tradable after?
I don't think you necessarily. I don't think you really trade around the debate. I think the debate is going to be much, you know, must-see TV. But really, when you think about it, there are seven states that are going to decide this election. Really, those swing states are going to be the only ones that really decide the election. But I do think that it's going to be an interesting debate to watch to see how they handle each other, to see whether or not one of them loses their cool or not. But I don't think you necessarily you trade around it, right? I mean, if you're a day trader, maybe yes. But as a long-term investor, you're not trading around, you know, tonight's debate at all. But I do think it's going to be an interesting debate to watch for sure, because you want to see, you know, what she has to say. She hasn't said anything so far. She hasn't said anything about her policies, right? How far left has she gone, or how far to the middle has she come, right? I mean, you saw what Bernie Sanders said on Sunday on Meet the Press, right, when asked about, you know, she's changing all her policies. He basically said, no, she's just trying to figure out, you know, where she needs to be to win this race.
Well,
right. So
people, that's what they're doing, right? I have a feeling.
After they win the race, then they go back to where they originally were.
I have
right?
a feeling.
That's the problem.
Looking at her background, Kenny, I have a feeling she's a little more center than people give her credit for.
Well, I would like to think she's center, although you look at some of the things that she says and some of the things that she supports. I mean, the idea that you and I have to pay for sex change operations immigrants or prisoners is absolutely beyond me. Yet she sits there and she said, these people need that, they need that surgery. Really?
That's just crazy.
Really? They need that surgery and I have to pay for it? That's where it gets ridiculous.
You watch some of the right-wing press, boy, they're all... When a couple of my right-wing people are convinced that you can, the 10-year-old can walk into Northwestern and get his sex changed, I go, no, he can't. What's up? What are you, crazy? No doctor would do that. I mean, without parental look. Anyway, not only is there the truth there somewhere, but boy, the fabrications are about as big as I've ever seen. How about you?
Yeah, but in California, they just passed that law, right? That Gavin Newsom passed a law that if your kid goes to school and he's Billy at home because he's a boy, but he goes to school, he wants to be called Susie, that the school doesn't have to notify the parents that Billy is now called Susie in school, the law now in California is no notifying the parents.
Well,
that's ridiculous. Are you kidding me?
That's crazy, but the right-wing press... has got it to the point that the same Billy can walk in and get basically things cut off without the parents' eyes, and that's not happening. I can't imagine that happening.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine it's happening. I can't imagine it's happening, but sometimes I wonder, in California, could it happen, right? Could that happen?
I don't think you can walk in the emergency room and get a stitch if you need it 8 hours, let alone get something else done.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
Kenny, thank you very much. You sound good, buddy. SP Futures up 4, NASDAQ Futures up 10. What do you say we go right to Professor, Ricardo?
Yeah, sounds good.
Professor, you with us?
How you doing, Tom?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. We're doing what we negotiated last week in the market very nicely for clients, so I guess we're on top of our game. I don't know what I think about going forward, whether we should be long, short, or in a vault somewhere. I don't know what the market is very...
Well, I think the Fed's getting ready to lower interest rates, so credit's going to be a little cheaper. Which makes mine on margin a little better.
why a guy like you who knows this stuff, the monetary stuff, I watch the press and I listen to Stocks and Jocks because I'm on it. The definition of this stuff, okay, when the Fed says they're going to do this, that, the other thing, they actually are maintaining amount of money in the pool so that a certain rate from bank to bank comes out at a certain amount, right? And the number has been 5.5 now for, what, a year or so, a year and a half, 2 years? And the story is that they're going to start bringing it down. Well, hell, we go to the auction every week. It's already down to 5.1. They've already lowered it 40%. Why don't people look at the number? And then you have people that say, well, the market's already doing it for them. They are the market. They're the ones that have been putting money into the system the last 5 months. They've already lowered this rate. Is it because of the
election? What's really going on is the Fed, I think they're kind of pretending that they're in control. I don't really think they are in control. I think what happens is the way interest on reserves work, it's like a dam. And out west, you have these dams. And you have snow melt. And if the snow melts too fast out of the mountains, the rivers all fill up and you get overtopping of dams. And so what the Fed does, it's printed a bunch of money. It printed a glut of money during the Trump administration. It continued to print that money during the first couple of years of the Biden administration. We didn't see M2 drop off a little bit, but it never got below its pre-pandemic trend. So what's going on here is, I think what was going on 2 years ago when they started raising interest rates were going up. The economy was probably a little too hot. And when it gets a little too hot, snow melts and the water rushes down the mountains, overtops the dam. So with the economy maybe running a little too hot, with all that stimulus pushed into it, that M2, all that money that the Fed printed to paper over the deficits that Trump and Biden created, their administrations oversaw, they have to raise the federal funds rate. They have to raise the interest that they pay on reserves. So they have to lift the dam up. And by lifting that dam up, they slow all those reserves that overtop the dam. And the reserves that overtop the dam, they go to their wealthy investors.
Oh, sure.
Right? That's where it leaks out. It leaks out to them, right? So what they have to do is they have to follow the market, and they push interest rates up to slow all those reserves that are trying to pour over the top because, you know, the economy is, you know,
well, ever since February, the money supply has been up every single month, and that's when that's when the 30 and 60 and 120 day bills that we go buy for people started, the rates started coming down. So if they would have kept dragging money out of the system, it would have gone from 5.5 to 6, not 5.5 to 5. I mean, I guess the question I'm trying to ask is why, since they've already done it, and anybody who kicks up M2 here that I just did in a second realizes it's already been done, why is this big political disaster? Why can't we say we already did it?
Yeah.
Especially when you say how transparent you are, every other word.
Yeah. Well, I think the more people say they're transparent, the more likely they're not being very transparent.
Did you ever, I've said this 100 times, you ever read that somewhere, someplace, and I lost it, some group, remember, they don't say it too much anymore, but remember when guys would go in front of Congress, you get all these old farts would stand there, and before they'd say anything, quite frankly, I think his name is Hal. You know, quite frankly, used to precede everything they said. This guy went through, and he fact-checked, I don't know how many hundred people, and he goes, when somebody says quite frankly, there's like a 60% chance what they say next is going to be a lie or something. But now they don't say that anymore. They talk about transparency, which is supposed to mean truthfulness, which really doesn't, does it? You would think. Isn't transparent supposed to be kind of a synonym for truth?
Oh, yeah. But I think the more people, like I said, more people who say they're transparent, I think they're hiding behind that transparency, which is kind of funny.
But why would, if somebody was transparent, just be transparent? If somebody doesn't lie, they just don't lie. You don't have to tell everybody, well, you know, without bearing false witness. You know?
Yeah, I think in today's world with the internet and social media, I think people who engage in creative transparency, they get found out pretty quick.
You know what? That's why I love arguing with you, Hal. I'm going to say that, you know, it should work that way. I'm with you 100%. I mean, back when, you know, Abraham Lincoln used to do like a whistle stop tour, unless, I don't even know if the same news guy followed him on the train, and if he said a little something different in Peoria than he did in Dixon, somebody would catch him on it. You know, I think
it was a lot easier to do that back then. I think it's very difficult to do it today.
Well, but here's my point. Everything that somebody does now, it's caught. But there's such a massive. I view the internet with the old joke on the trading floor. You can't take a drink out of a fire hydrant. You know.
Well, you can, but your cheeks get pretty extended.
Yeah. it's not so good. You might get your head knocked off too.
It doesn't feel good, but if you're really thirsty, it'll be all right.
Yeah, you might stick your hand in there or something. But with all this mess on the internet and the fact that people only go to the spots where the interpretation of what you said or what I said comes through somebody else, I don't think it even matters. These guys don't care if they say something on a Tuesday and something else on a Thursday. Yes, if you really look at it, if you're a guy like Kevin or somebody who really digs from one side or the other, and you can say, gee, Hal said this on Tuesday in Butler, Pennsylvania, and on Thursday he said exactly the opposite somewhere else. I think by Thursday it's lost, Hal. It doesn't even. I think they're less worried about it now than they were before.
Well, I think over time, over the long run, I think people are going to be held accountable. I think in the short run you can get away with it.
I
think you can get away with a lot of things in the short run. In my macroeconomics class, we talk about the PPF, the production possibility frontier, and it just models the trade-off that you have to make in the short run. But you don't have to make that in the long run. The freer society is, the less corruption there is, the less crime there is, the more property rights are protected. Over the long run, those scarcities disappear. That's only a problem in the short run. Or it's a problem in a very tyrannical economic system like North Korea, right? There's definitely trade-offs over the long run or in the short run. But in a free society where property rights are protected, the PPF is not a long-run issue. It's a short-run problem.
Well, we have property rights might be protected, but we shut down
some people's ability to run a restaurant and not other people's.
Well, for, that was a violation of their property rights, yeah. though. So well, we yeah. violated their property rights.
Well, but I'm saying we seem to do it enough to screw people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm teaching this health economics class right now, and it's really the first time since graduate school that I've been exposed to any of the modeling. And it's pretty amazing. Like, for example, we think a copay is a really good thing, but it really isn't. You throw a copay in a drug that's got monopoly because the government has given it a patent. What goes on is it's exactly what I thought about insurance when I went and saw a GI doctor back in 2011.
Now you mean an abdominal doctor, not an army doctor?
No, yeah, exactly. I had an issue with bowel restrictions, and I had to go see a GI doctor. But I was like, man,
right away before you exploded.
Yeah, right before I exploded. Yeah. But I was thinking when I was paying my copay, I only saw a PA. I only saw a PA for like 20 minutes. And I got charged $80 for the copay, right? And I was thinking that's the most I would have paid that guy. But I guarantee you the office there probably billed that appointment out at like probably $500. And sure enough, it was basically $500. So what goes on with copay is that it actually rotates the demand curve clockwise from like the quantity axis. It rotates it clockwise. So what's going on really is that if the medicine costs $50, that's if the copay for a medicine is $50 and the copay is 20%, and that results in a copay of $50, that consumer, because of the copay, it rotates the demand curve out. The amount that's being charged to the insurance company is probably more like $250. So in order to figure out what happens with these prices and why these prices are extremely high, one, you have the fact that they can monopoly price. They can restrict supply and push prices up demand curve, right? And then you throw on the copay, and that rotates the demand curve outward. So the drug company is not only monopoly pricing, they're also able to increase the price that they get from the insurance company by taking the copay and divide it by the percentage of the copay. It's really fascinating stuff. So
if you don't have let me ask you a question. If you don't have a listed prices, how do you have any idea that the copay percentage you pay versus what the insurance company pays is being coming off the same number?
Well, think about it. If the maximum you're willing to pay for a drug is, say, $50, right? And there's a 20% copay. Well, guess what? Your copay is at $50. So what happens to that consumer's maximum willingness to pay? It gets increased to $250 because the insurance company's paying the difference between the $250 and the $50. The $50 is the out-of-pocket.
Well, that's my question. Why do you trust them that's what they're paying?
Who, the insurance company?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. Makes you think they're not getting a different price.
Yeah. Well, the power is really with the power is really with the pharmaceutical company because they have a patent on this drug that a doctor has prescribed.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of I slipped off your topic here, off your test question, yeah. Professor. I was thinking about just in general, what makes you think that the pharmaceutical people charge the same amount to everybody? I should have my friend back on. It is. This is a guy. He's a good client, good friend. He was on the board of Osco Drug in his 20s. The dude knows more about that business than just about anybody I've ever talked to. I mean, more than Carl. I'm not talking about the theory of it, but why do you think that these pharmacy benefit managers all showed up and all of a sudden everybody had to own one? And why the drug companies, like Walgreens, those people are having trouble? The money's being siphoned off by the pharmacy.
Oh, yeah.
By the pharmacy.
100%, yeah.
So I'll give you a quick example. And the gentleman here in the building, He's engineer, janitor, wherever you want to, takes care of the place. Terrific guy, good friend of mine, had a hernia surgery. And I, you know, these kind of questions, he comes to me or my brother Dan, we're really good friends, and he goes, "Hey, big guy, what do I do on this?" Well, he's having hernia surgery. You know, I use the term a simple hernia, which means it's on somebody else, not you, right? But it wasn't like, four different spots they got to get. It was basically one spot, which is still, a pain if it's you. So he goes, I said, how much do they want for that? And he said, well, his particular policy, it's one of the crappy Blue Cross Blue Shields, the deductible is $5,000, and then he's got to pay 20% of the cost of whatever goes on in the hospital. And the number came out to like $9,500. Okay, so I said, there's places that will do hernia surgery for a lot less than that.
Yeah.
And of course, I look that up, and there's places that'll do it for, I think it was like $3,500 if they used the machine, and $4,000 if they didn't, something like that. But basically, one was like $9,500, and the other was like $4,500 or $35,000, somewhere in there. Given that it was in January, which means the deductible will be gone for the whole year. Now, he's got a family with wife and two kids. So I'm thinking, I could not tell him, Hal, whether or not it was better to pay the $9,500 or the $4,500. The more I went through it, so when I usually have something like that, I ask my brother, who's a CPA, and he goes, "You're right on. I can't tell either." Which was the... Now, if it was December, I would have said, and you have a... You still had your deductible at $5,000, you might have wanted to go with the $4,500, type of deal. But I'm going to say that if somebody's willing to do it for $4,500 or $4,000, whatever it was, now his bill from the hospital was going to be, if he had to pay $2,000 over, that's 20%. So if that's 20, they wanted $10,000 for the surgery. Now, my first thing and my suspicious Southside mind is, the number they're calling his 20% off of, there's no way the insurance company is paying 8 if somebody else is willing to do it for 4. I think they're giving him one number that the 20% comes off, and the insurance company is nowhere in hell paying 8. And I think if that happens, I'd put lassos around the cells, the L-tracks, and start hanging people. That to me is absolute cheating to people, and I have this sneaking feeling.
Oh yeah, it's going on. I agree 100%. But I think the reason why we hear these stories about these incredible drug prices is, one, they have the ability to monopoly price, right? Because the government gives them a legal monopoly, right?
Yep.
And then two, the copay, the way the copay works theoretically, is that if it's 20%, that means the consumer's maximum willingness to pay, the point on the demand curve where that consumption happens, is 5 times higher, one divided by 0.2, than it would have been in the absence of the copay.
Right, but what makes you think that the 20% is something, the something doesn't change?
I'm not sure. Can you rephrase the question?
Well, when you say your copay is $50,
and it's
20%, you're assuming that the insurance company is paying $200 and that the price is $250.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
Yeah, but why assume that?
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, in medicine, the product supply curve is actually the product supply curve, which, what's being exchanged in the product market, in the service market. Maybe you define it as hours of time purchased with the doctor, right? So in that regard, hours spent with a doctor, not only is the consumer the demander of the physician's labor, they're also the demander of the physician's product. So the labor market is essentially the product market. They're like one and the same, right? If you make some simplifying assumptions, they end up being the same. So all I'm saying is that when you interpret a demand curve as the maximum willingness or ability to pay by the consumers that are actually in the market at that point in time, and they're paying a copay of 50, and that 50 is the most they would have paid for a drug or a medical service in the absence of insurance, then what happens is the copay, they're getting really good at this. People know that the copay that people pay is probably what they'd be willing to pay for that. But there's this third-party payer system that we have.
Well, the original intention, in one man's opinion, and grade me here, Professor, I had a client years and years ago.
Oh, I know the original intent, but I'm just...
But it's far and away. Yeah, but it's far and away from that now. Yeah. The original intent was, if people if they make a decision to go see a doctor, if they don't have to pay something, they're liable to go and they don't need it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah.
The original idea was, even if it's not the full price, if I'm going to go because I think I have a headache or something. Of course, I drank too much last night. I should know what the headache's from, but I don't. I go anyway. Just because I like going to doctors, I got nowhere else to go. And there are people like that. It was never like me. I don't want to go to
my wife was like that with our first son. We were paying the pediatrician's rent. I would joke about that every time she took him in to have his, you know, temperature checked or...
Yeah. Well, I mean, that with the first kid, you know, it's human nature.
I think we spent more time at the pediatrician than we spent at home.
Anyway, this client had a factory down in... this is how far what you're talking about, Cal. I guess you don't realize how right you are. When he had a factory down in Columbus, Indiana, right? This is, you know, 60s, I imagine. And he was paying all his insurance, right? And he probably had, I don't know how many people there. But up until a few years ago, anyway, it's another long story. But anyway, he said, I tell you what, I'm paying all this insurance. Why don't I do this? Why don't I just go out and paying all these people are paying this insurance. I'm just going to go get a high-end policy for somebody really has a problem. And the things you really have to watch out for are some kind of a cancer thing. But also is if you have somebody has a baby that has a problem because of the cost of keeping a kid. And that's even more than cancer. Anyway, it's need to know basis, but he told everybody, now look, if you go to the I'm going to give you like $500 a year toward paying toward these deductibles, and other than that, I'm just going to write a check to the doctor. But this, now the catchphrase here, as you might say, that makes a lot of sense. Anyway, he said that was the biggest profit center in the factory the next 3 years. The thing that set it apart, I mean say if PTI, and what's his name?
Bob, so he was essentially the third party payer.
Yeah, he was insured except for the high end stuff, wow. The loyal. But the thing of it is, and even if you have say we had PTI and we had 50 employees, but Bob Cerrone used to be on the show. He was in that business, the HR business. He said if you're 50 people, you're way better off pulling the prescription piece out of your other insurance and doing that in house. And self-insuring. But the problem that is now, why can't, you know, Chief Hale, Cheatham & Howe law firm that has 500 people self-insure, except for big events? Because we can't get the same prices as the other people. That sucks. That is what absolutely is so wrong with this. And that's why whenever you or Carl go down the road is... It's not anywhere near a fair market. We don't get price.
No.
There's no way on earth that if we self-insure and Ricardo needs an appendectomy, we can pay 40 when somebody else is paying 20.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So that is the huge... That's why this whole thing has built this massive wall. It's not free enterprise. It's not even a monopoly.
It's the opposite.
It's like fascism. It's absolutely crony capitalism to a huge extent.
It is, yeah. Well, you know, you look at what's going on in Australia. In Australia, I was doing a little research on it, and in 2017, the population growth was slower than the growth in chronic diseases. Population of chronic diseases and the demand for healthcare. The demand for healthcare was growing more rapidly than the population. But in Australia, it's the government planned, managed, owned system for the most part, and they cut a bunch of money out of their public health budget, like $1.5 billion over the long run, according to this researcher in Australia. They basically did not grow supply at a fast enough pace. And if you remember, the basis of the lockdown was that they didn't want to have a situation where all the beds are full. But so when you have government managing the system like in Australia, they have a supply that can't handle the worst possible day.
Well, nobody can.
But Outback Steakhouse, when you go to Outback Steakhouse, unlike a little steak, the best steakhouse in Lewiston, Idaho, Bojack's. Bojack's, on their busiest day, which is usually Valentine's, you have to wait 3 hours at your table to get your food. At Outback Steakhouse, I had a girlfriend that worked at an Outback Steakhouse back in the 1990s, and she was telling me about the operation. I'm thinking, oh, they built in this capacity that will handle the busiest day of the year, right? And so when you go into Outback Steakhouse,
yeah, you're not always staffed.
You're in and out.
You're not always staffed for it.
Yeah, but you're in and out. You can be in and out at an Outback Steakhouse on the busiest night of the year.
Well, we got
the problem is that in Australia they didn't grow the supply of healthcare services at the pace they needed to, and they were having trouble with availability of beds before the pandemic. When the pandemic hit, like in America, the beds all filled up. In America, they filled up because we have things like con laws, convenience of need, where an incumbent hospital can veto the proposal to build a new hospital across the street. That's like giving McDonald's veto power over Burger King wanting to build a McDonald's across the street. I guarantee McDonald's wishes they had the ability to veto competitors, but in 30 plus days, they have this power essentially to say, we don't need a new hospital across the street because that would represent a duplicative services.
Well, we don't
have duplicative services are the things that drives down the price and increases the quality in the customer service.
We don't have any sort of common sense in any of this stuff, and we have all these.
Oh no, it's common sense.
Well, I'm saying
it's common sense.
Well, for them, but I mean, look at the
for them. Oh yeah,
but look at
yeah.
the money. I mean, if next time you come to Chicago, for sure as hell, I'd rather go to a bar tour than I'll drive you by two or three of the hospitals now that are just growing by like weeds.
Oh yeah, they're big, huge monopolists.
But
they're Johnny Rockefellers.
But
man.
I'm saying there's money that goes into these places from government and people,
yeah.
and the people who run them line the crap out of their pockets with this dough.
But oh yeah.
If you walk into Northwestern,
the administrative bloat there is probably worse than it is.
Well, I'm saying what is the reason for a hospital is to treat people that are sick.
Yeah.
I'm going to say if you walked in and you and I walked in with a, I'll show my age, we walked in with a tape measure. And we were to take the square footage in the hospital that's designed for patient care versus offices, coffee shops, all the other crap that's in the place.
I know where you're going with this.
But I'm saying, and I don't have a problem with that necessarily,
yeah.
but
yeah.
if I'm paying for a first floor that has pianos, coffee shops, other kinds of stuff, I want some stuff in the ceiling or someplace that I can pull partitions, and if I had to, if there was a war or a building went down or it was an earthquake, I could put 300 people on this first floor. There's nothing like that. There's no possible. Then you can put somebody in a gurney and leave them in the hallway. I mean, they can do that, but that I mean, I'm going to say Northwestern probably can hold, I don't know, 500 people, 400 people, maybe. That building should be able to care for 5,000 in an emergency. And it
well, it does care for 5,000. It's probably got 4,500 employees.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying if we're really going to do it, what happened to all the 9/11 stuff?
Yeah,
where we had the ability. By the way, that's tomorrow, right? Is the anniversary?
Yeah. Yep.
But I mean,
it was a Tuesday, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was a Tuesday.
But I mean, why are these places? How many people? If we had that was the problem with COVID. I mean, these places are not designed. I mean, if you go back to today, I'm not saying, oh boy, no masks or anything like that, but hospital is not designed for somebody to be real sick.
Yeah.
Real, is it? I mean, there's no way that you walk in and say, gee, I think I got measles or polio. They're going to say, walk to the main desk, buy 100 people.
Yeah.
I mean, it is not designed at all. Like you.
Every time I've gone to a hospital, I've seemed to get a cold or I've gotten sick.
Well, that's where I caught COVID. Was yeah. in the hospital.
Yeah.
I mean, duh. We're gonna dash off the break here when we come back. Well, let's talk more about the markets and what's going on here and some of these prices. And you know, some of these stocks are somewhat heavy in terms of pricing. Down a little bit after last week. Does that mean they're somewhat of a relative buy? We're running up here. S&P futures up 12. NASDAQ futures up 47. We're going to try and make back most of last week. I mean, that's what we do is we go back up and people put money in to make sure it does. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Good morning.
Give us a call about your stock. 888-76-JOCKS. That's 888-765-6257. Or email us, stocksandjocks@live.com. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tamayo Ricardo on the board. S&P futures up 13. Now they were down when we came in. NASDAQ futures up 49. So we're trying to make a run at last week. We had a big up day yesterday. But not as big as the down day on Friday. But it was, you know, it definitely was a bounce. Yesterday we were up we were up 484 in the Dow, which, you know, it was almost, you know, it was a real good comeback. S&P was up 62, which made back at least two-thirds of Friday. NASDAQ was up 193. It was down 4-something on Friday, so not so much there. But still, you know, better than going down. Europe, we've got the... over in Europe, we have... My machine is a little slower. I don't know why that is today, but it'll be on here in a second. The individual stocks in the Dow, I've got Goldman Sachs down 3. I've got J.P. Morgan up 294. I've got Microsoft up 288. So nothing crazy going on in there. I don't know why my machine. Why don't you do traffic, weather, sports, and we'll come back and I'll kick my machine.
For sure.
Oh, here we are. DAX down 72.4%. Kind of surprising. FTSE up down 38.5. CAC round up 22.3. So the markets over there are probably slightly down. Over in Asia, which were down heavy yesterday. Nikkei's down 56 today, only 0.2%. Hang Seng, however, making, boy, there's not much of a bounce here. Up 37 points. It was down like several hundred yesterday. 17,234, which is hanging near the way low end of this range. Shanghai up 7, but 2744, under 2750 for second day in a row. Again, China seems to be having nothing but trouble. Bonds unchanged 3.71. The Bund unchanged 2.18. Japan unchanged 0.90. Oil, which has been really down again today, down 79 cents, 67.92. It's nice buying gas at the prices today. Although, Ricardo, it's still buck higher in the city than the suburbs. Isn't that swell living here? Yet another tax, the city of Chicago. Brent down 77 cents, 71.07. Natural gas up 7 cents, 224. RBOB unchanged at 191. Gold up 340, just hanging right around this 2,500, 2,536, in the middle 2,500 range. Silver up 11 cents, 28.77. Copper down 2 cents, 412. We've got the foreign exchange. Euro 110.3, so the dollar's gotten stronger. It was over 111 last week. British pound, same way, 130.9. Was like 131, almost 132 last week. Japan at 142.86, and we got Bitcoin rebounding a little bit here, up 292, 57,331. What do you have for us, Trevi Weather Sports? Cubs won late.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:38 here in beautiful Chicago. We got 59 degrees right now with a high of 84, mostly sunny and very warm. Tonight's going to be clear with a low of 64 degrees. Over to Phoenix, Arizona, 82 degrees right now with a high of 110. Hot with plenty of sunshine, but there is danger of dehydration and heat stroke if outside for too long. Tonight's going to be clear with a low of 79 degrees. On the traffic in Chicago, it's a mess today to get out of the city. Inbound Kennedy from Monroe, 61 minutes. We're looking at 94 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook. Inbound Eisenhower from Wall, 52 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th, 39, and another 47 minutes. Inbound Stevenson from 24 to the Dan Ryan. Lastly, sports. White Sox lose to Guardians 3-5 yesterday, and the Cubs beat the Dodgers 10-4. Today we got a couple more games. White Sox play the Guardians at 6:40 p.m. Diamondbacks play the Rangers at 8:40 p.m. and the Cubs play the Dodgers at 9:10 p.m. Lastly, the NFL started last week. The Eagles beat the Packers 34-29 in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And then the Cardinals lost to the Bills 34-28, and the Bears beat the Titans 24-17. Back over to you, Chief.
The world is right. The Bears won. Everything's okay.
Yeah, I know, right?
Everything's cool. Hell, crazy stuff. The stock prices are kind of high historically. We've got Elon Musk now kind of ranting on his Bitcoin a little bit. A lot of wealth tied up in that stuff. You look around for the landmines, it seems like there might be a few, but I don't know. I mean, we've been like this for quite a while. I'm not so sure that we don't hang in there much longer. What do you think the government is going to do regarding the debt stuff? I mean, the taxes, the tax decrease expires in what? Early 26? So those taxes come back, right?
Yeah.
Now, you know, on the Republican side, they're ranting and raving about the spending, and yet they have no intention of either cutting it or raising any of the taxes.
Oh, they're not going to cut any spending.
And on the Democratic side, they think all this spending is going to come back to them in spades someday. I don't see how that necessarily works out that way. But
I don't think they actually do. I think they actually know that spending more doesn't lead to prosperity in the future. I think they know that. You know, they're just buying votes. The Republicans buy votes with promises of lowering your taxes and easing regulation, and the Democrats get votes by, you know, spending a bunch of money.
But it's going. No matter who. I mean, that's why in this presidential race,
it's all signaling.
I grade me on this. I think we've reached. Well, maybe I would have thought this a year or two ago, but I really now think that we've reached the point that it really almost doesn't matter in terms of policy, you know, tax and spend policy, whoever the next president is. Either one of them is going to get the sharp slap in the face, like if it's, you know, the old Aqua Velva commercial.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers don't lie. I mean, I don't care what you or your wife's policy is towards going into debt or not, or who's for it or who's against it. The fact is, if the House all of a sudden reaches the point where we won't lend you anymore, the rates for you to borrow are now 50% instead of 25, someplace, somewhere, somebody's got to look in the mirror. And I don't care who's going to be next president. The mirror is right there.
Yeah, well, the problem with our current system is that these politicians get elected by promising exactly what they're giving us, right? And the costs aren't borne for, you know, a generation. And by the time those costs are borne by us, these guys aren't going to be in office, right? So they've used fiscal policy and monetary policy in a way to get elected. And when the bills come due, you know, they've either passed on or they're no longer in office. So that's the problem with the economists that advise them, right?
Well,
the economists that advise them, they're probably, most economists are, you know, probably white male. They probably went to the best public schools. They probably went to the best.
Plus, they're on the take. They're not telling the truth. Yeah. Look at these buffoons on TV. They're economists. They're not telling the truth.
Well, the reason why they're not is because they're selling. They're the snake oil salesmen of the politicians that they want to work for, right? And if their policy prescriptions get adopted, they're not going to have to worry about the cost of the consequences, because they're going to do fine. They're from these families where they've always done fine, right? So they don't bear the cost. Me, on the other hand, I came up poor. I mean, I came up so poor that during the summer, we didn't have shoes, and we didn't have shorts, and we didn't have T-shirts. On our farm, we played in the dirt, in the grass, in our underwear. And
well, if you got a worn-out pair of pants at the knees, that becomes shorts pretty easy.
Yeah. Well, I also had to, in order to get a bike, I remember in fifth grade, I found a bike like at the junkyard, and I took it home, and I fixed it. I oiled the chain. I put new tires and inner tube in it, right? I fixed it. In order to get a bike to go to my best friend's house, I had to find a bike at a junkyard, fix it up. I was really good at fixing things. I'd fix it up, and then I could ride it to and from my friend's house. So I'm interested in policies that are going to make us better off. I am so anti-current system, mainstream economics, it's unreal, because I've learned that mainstream economics, mainstream economists, people who get their PhDs, are getting a PhD in an area where their research is twisted in a way, because you can twist statistics. You twist your statistics in a way that is going to land you a job for a Senate committee or a senator or a president, right? You like, if you grew up on the Upper East Side, you're probably going to pick macroeconomics. You're probably going to pick Keynesian economics because you think government is good. So you're gonna look for data and research that confirms the policies that you agree with that'll help get such a senator or president elected, right? Because you eventually want that job as an advisor. And the same thing happens to a guy that grows up in Idaho. They're probably going to be drawn to, you know, monetary school or neoclassical economics. Why? Because that's what they know. That's what they're attracted to. And if they can do their research in a way that supports all those interventions of the monetarist, of the neoclassicalist, or the supply-siders, they're going to find a nice cushy job with those.
I can never even figure out where the supply-side economics came from. I think it was all Houdini's crap.
Well, actually, it comes from the 11th century. A Muslim scholar who wrote something I think is called like the Maqdif. I can't pronounce it. But
Bush once said it was voodoo economics, right?
Well, yeah, Bush did, you know, the former CIA director. But it actually comes from the 11th century. The first time it's talked about is by this Islamic scholar back in the 11th or 12th century. And he wrote this really thick book. And it covers everything, mathematics, history, economics, right? That's where economics really got its start. And he made the observation that when a state first starts out, its tax rates are low and its revenues are high. But over time, what happens in history is as that kingdom promises more and more goodies, it's got to raise taxes, and that ultimately results in less revenue. So it's actually the Maqdif curve, not the Laffer curve.
Well, in class, I still remember this, and I'm gonna say you're going to critique the Nobel Prize winners, how much time makes a difference in the world, right? Yeah. Somebody asked Milton Friedman, are you concerned about the national debt? And what do you suppose his answer was?
He probably said no.
He said, I'm absolutely not concerned about it. Yeah. It's just like, because if you have a house and the wife's a spender or the other way around and the husband gives her the dough and one owes a bunch to the other, the house is flat, using a trading term. The house doesn't owe any dough, even though the wife might owe the husband or the husband owe the wife because he's losing at golf or something. But now, when you have 30-some percent of the money in the U.S. debt owed by people out of the country, it actually peaked in like 2014 with like 30-some, maybe almost 40. If you have China, which I think is still the biggest one, maybe, or China and Japan, if one of those people, like if the Chinese stuff implodes, or Japan, which has debt twice their GDP there, if all of a sudden they don't show up, even for a little bit, I could see these 10-year rates here, if the economy goes down and the government keeps spending this money, I could see these 10-year rates at 10-12%. You know, that's my biggest nightmare. And
the problem with Milton Friedman's thinking is that I think back then it's probably okay not to dismiss it, but today what you have is a system where the Federal Reserve is the crack dealer and
they were doing that back then. That's crack, what,
or the politicians.
Well, that's what he railed about back then. They were doing the same thing.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is today, I think it's much worse today.
They were money supply growth. I actually have it here somewhere buried in my place. They were money supply growth at 7-12% a year from 1971 to 80 to pay for the Vietnam War. They did almost the exact same thing as we did.
Yeah, but I think back then, though, politicians on both sides of the aisle, there were some in both parties who actually worried about the debt, right? Today, what they do is neither party worries about the debt. nobody's concerned by it. If they express concern, it's all faux, right? It's not real. And so what you have today is the Fed, it creates a moral hazard. The Fed has announced to everybody in the world that if the Republicans and the Democrats in the White House and Congress run a $2 trillion debt, the Federal Reserve will print the money to cover and paper over those deficits. So what does that lead to? It just leads to an explosion in debt. And so the Fed has become the drug dealer, and the people that are addicted to the Fed's money are the politicians, the irresponsible ones, the ones that probably couldn't succeed if they tried their hand in the private sector, they probably would fail miserably. But for some reason, who is drawn to politics? People who are quote unquote transparent, right? I don't think so.
No, I mean it's a different business, and nobody, most people. But you know what's interesting here? If you look at the federal debt to GDP ratio, but again, it comes down to numbers versus percentages, and you know, as a mathematician, you got to be careful with that one, right?
Yeah.
Actually, in 1960, the federal debt to GDP was 52%. We're only talking 15 years after World War II, and Korea, right, was right after that, and by the way, the Cold War. So, but the numbers had to be very small. And that number dropped to 34% in 1980.
Yeah,
because people were concerned about the debt. And all of a sudden,
in both parties.
Yeah, and now we were back up to 56% in 2000, and now we're 123%.
Yeah.
You know, and we've had some wars that have drained. I mean, I was when the Afghan was
we've chosen wars.
Well, so the Afghan war
pockets a lot of connected people.
Well,
right?
I how can I put it this way? When we decided to invade Iraq, second time. The first time, you know, it was in response to them doing bad stuff. But the second time, I forget what the estimate of the war going in, because Bush 2 decided to go to war because he was run by the neocons. Somebody wanted the oil over there.
His dad was the CIA director.
Yeah, and then what, Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Wasn't his dad also the head man in Texas? In the CIA back.
Yeah, he also was one of the main planners of the Bay of Pigs.
Yeah.
And there's some people think he was involved with Kennedy. I'm not going to go that far, but.
Well, I think he was in Texas that month. He doesn't remember where he was.
He was in Texas that day.
Yeah, he was Kennedy in Texas killed. That day, but he doesn't remember where he was.
Yeah.
When a president gets killed, that's something you remember. When 9/11 happened, I remember to this day where I was the moment 9/11 happened. I was about to find out how I did on my core exams in my PhD program. I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, as I normally do, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm watching the business news, and my jaw drops. I'm in my bedroom, I turn the news on, I think it's Fox Business, and I'm looking at this going, what just happened to the Twin Towers, right?
Yeah.
Then later that day, I found out that I failed my micro core, and I passed my macro core. Which I didn't expect. My micro was my thing. I didn't study for it. I studied for macro. I passed it. I didn't study for micro. I failed. So I remember exactly what was going on that day, right?
I think I was in fourth grade.
Bush, he doesn't remember where he was at the moment that Kennedy was shot, I just don't buy it. That goes back to these people who say they're transparent. These people aren't transparent.
I was in fourth grade, and I remember every girl in the place balling.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I remember exactly. I was in fourth grade.
You don't forget those moments. You just don't.
Anyway, the number is now up to 123. Now the question is,
and it's going to get worse.
But you know,
here's the thing to think about: if GDP is overestimated because of the things they do with the inflation, right? They hide inflation. I think it's pretty obvious they hide inflation. What really is it, right? You know they're hiding debt, right? They're under-reporting that. We kind of feel like they are. They're under-reporting inflation. So GDP gets inflated.
Well, I don't know, it's maybe more of
it's probably even worse than we think.
It's more of a Carl question. If you look at the federal receipts and expenditures, they come out with it's, no, I can find that page. I'll find it tomorrow, but Or maybe I will try and find it. But I think we're talking about maybe $1 trillion a year. We're in the hole, right? $1.2 trillion, something like that?
Well, I think it's averaging about 1.5.
Well, the federal spending is 6.9, and federal tax revenue is 5.03. All right, so we're... I guess what I'm saying is, if you look at the actual,
Tom, you remember the day when you thought $225 billion deficits were huge?
Hell, I don't have any idea of what $1 trillion even looks like. I mean, what I'm saying here is, if you look at the thing they print from the budget deficit,
yeah,
let's say it's $1.2 trillion or something, but you actually look at the national debt. Is growing almost at 50% or 60% higher rate than the deficit. Now, what's not on the balance sheet? I guess is my question, and nobody seems to know. Even on the show with all the bright people we have, nobody seems to know. And whose job it is to say, "Oh no, put that one on the budget." No, don't put that one. How does one grow faster than the other?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'll see if I can find it real quick. Because they have the Treasury statement comes out every month.
Well, if you read this paper that Paul Krugman wrote back, it's a funny piece, right? He wrote this parody of international trade, right? And all these nations report their trade deficits, right? And he added up all the trade deficits and all the trade surpluses, and he concluded that we had a trade deficit with Martians. And this is back in the 1990s, right? It was a pretty funny piece.
Well, I mean, I just wonder what's the difference. I mean, I mean, it's really hard to. Here, I'll look here. The current monthly Treasury statement.
Maybe it's something as simple as the Soviets. You know, the Soviets overstated GDP growth. We thought Samuelson was estimating Soviet Union GDP at 50% of America. It ended up being 5%. Right? Why? Because people believe what these states tell them in terms of their statistics. Right. If you're a statistician in a despotic dictatorship in South America or Africa, are you going to go with the low estimate for unemployment? Or are you going to go with the high estimate for unemployment? Which one are you going to publish? Right. You got 95% confidence interval. If you publish the center of that confidence interval, you're going to get fired. If you publish the high end of the confidence interval, you're going to get probably executed. So you report the lower end of the confidence interval to keep your job and keep your head, right?
Right. I'm looking right at it here. In 2023 fiscal year, and don't forget our fiscal year ends at the end of September, so we're coming up on a fiscal year here. Last year the deficit was $1.7 trillion.
Yeah.
This year it's like $1.6 trillion. Now, this is the weird part. We have one more month, actually two more months to go. And we're almost, our revenues, our tax receipts in this economy that everybody says is burgeoning, all you do is listen for 10 minutes and everybody tells you how good everything is. It's sort of like the old line in the movie, "Don't piss on my boots and tell me it's raining," or something along those lines. Anyway, so we're...
Or actually pee on my contract.
Yeah, or like in Major League. So let's just say the last 2 years plus 2 months that we don't have yet, we're at $3.2 trillion. In the hole. All right. Well, that's interesting. Except I have a belief here that if you go back 2 years on the national debt clock, we're way more than $3.2 trillion in debt over that period of time. And I guess my question is that I can't figure out.
Well, those deficit payments include the interest you're paying on the debt, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in 2020, it was 28. All right, and now. It's 28.7 so we're up. And this is probably not exactly on the. We're up in 4 years. We're pushing 7, and it really should be the last 2 years 3.2. It's like $1 trillion over what you would expect it to be.
Well, I think if the press were actually the press, they would ask these kind of questions. Maybe the press, the people in the press. Maybe they failed or got D's and C's in recon classes, and they can't formulate the questions to these people.
I have this argument all the time with the right wingers on the show. The press, and they of course think they're all just favoring the liberal side. Fact is, I don't think that there's any. Well, if anybody, hell, you were. I don't think you were on the show back then. We had a guy. Talk about Southside, Pedro de Costa, and he was our economic guy. He would come on every 3-4 weeks for a little bit. He was our Washington Treasury Fed guy, and he was a bright guy. And he was actually in one of these things with Janet Yellen. They didn't do the press conference after every Fed meeting back then. It was like, what, 3 or 4 a year they did?
Yeah.
So he's on there, and at the time, remember the Fed was accused. We covered it on the show. Somebody from Hong Kong or something wrote this big article about how the Fed is being front-run on all their announcements, especially if one of these idiots goes over and has a policy speech in the middle of China in the middle of the night. All of a sudden, people seem to know about it, except us, right? Yeah. And the guy wrote this thing showing all these different occasions where these Fed announcements were front-run. Mm. He said the labor numbers never were front-run. Somehow the labor kept them quiet, or maybe they're just not good to trade on. Well, there was a big hue and cry in Washington, lasted about a week, and the Fed said, don't worry, we'll investigate it. Nobody else can come in into our underwear, basically, and investigate it. And they got away with that, which is really, really screwed up, right? But they did. So about 6 months later, Pedro at one of these things says, Chairman Yellen, can you let us know how that investigation is going into the front-running stuff? I've never seen anybody, Miss Old Grandma, her whole body stiffened, and her face hardened, and she looked at him like if she'd had a broomstick, she'd have been going right after him. She wanted no part of that. The Wall Street Journal got called afterward, and he was never invited back.
Wow, yeah.
So
these people don't like to be asked tough questions.
So these people aren't news people in the sense of Edward R. Murrow or Walter Cronkite. They aren't afraid of the people they're talking to. They are afraid. And the Wall Street Journal can't have a press conference where they're not invited. I mean, look at what Steve Leisman asks the guy from CNBC. Yeah. He's willing to be the guy's lapdog to be able to get the first question. And you know what? Maybe we'd be the same way if we were making as much as Steve Leisman doing whatever he's doing out there.
I don't think I would because I got these core principles. I've always been a contrarian. I've never towed the line.
There was a song about you.
I mean,
even after all these years pushing against the wind, after all these years,
I'm a contrarian. I have a problem with authority. That's why I love being a professor, because I get to do my thing. I get to do it my way, right? I considered working in the private sector, but I'd have to do somebody else's research. I'd have to answer questions that I have no interest in. So I just don't think. If I was in front of somebody like the president or a senator, I would just ask them questions, and I wouldn't care the consequences, because there's things I want to know.
But there's, obviously, you know, I do the show, right? And and 99% of what you're talking about, I wouldn't do this if I didn't want to, and have guys like you on and learn, and other people can learn, and basically push against the wind, right? I mean, that's what we're doing. To a certain extent, we're trying to tell the truth, but the truth seems conflicting with what's happening these days, right?
Well, you know, in the short run, being in the herd is great, but in the long run, everybody goes over the cliff, and I don't want to go over the cliff. I'm not going to take those kinds of risks.
But the economy is shrinking to somewhat of an extent, and if somebody makes their way to be a Wall Street Journal and person like that, and now, you know, I love Pedro. I got to try and get him back on one of these days. I don't know what he's doing, but if he all of a sudden, if it's just him and it's just me, I don't really have a problem with that. Let me give you an example. Judge Tooman died last year, a good friend of mine and real good friend of a lot of people I know, died at age 82 or something. Well, Judge Tooman was one of these absolutely above reproach kind of guys in the, and he had the Jeff Fort case that nobody else wanted it because there's like machine guns in front of the courthouse. I mean, this was a big deal. And he was getting all these threats from everybody, and they were legit, to where there were police on his block. Of course, he didn't want them. And I just sit there and go, you know, this is incredible that a guy has basically that kind of stones. He's a little Irish guy, not afraid of anything. And the Marine. All of a sudden, I'm sitting there and go, you know, Tom, wake up. Grow up. If he would have had a wife and four daughters walking off to school every day, I wonder if he would have wanted that case.
Yeah.
Or if Pedro needed the jab at Walt. I mean, we all bend a little. I mean, as much as...
I think the way I bend in... I try not to use inflammatory, insulting language. I try to use the narratives that, you know, the people I'm debating, they have certain narratives they're going to use, certain things that they support. I tend to use that against them in reasoned arguments. That's what I try.
I am too. I'm just saying, if we had worked 10 years for that spot at Wall Street Journal,
yeah,
and we're a single guy, you know, and we got to, you know, and we, I, you know, we could care less about it. We can go somewhere else. We can go paint houses if we wanted to. We don't have any debt. What if he just got married and bought the house, and you just had the wife popped out twins, you had triplets, and all of a sudden you did said something like that, and you come home and, hey, honey, I'm out of a job. That's a tough
thing. Yeah, that's what they do. See, in America, there's a soft tyranny. In the Soviet Union, they send you to labor camp. They send you to Siberia. In China, they put you in labor camp. In North Korea, they send you to labor camp, or if you're really bad, they just execute you. In America, you just lose your job, right?
Well,
if you're contrarian, you lose your job.
And back in the 60s or something, people weren't as afraid of that necessarily because you could get another job. Or worst that could happen is you go paint houses on a weekend with your brother-in-law and make some money there. I mean, the house and the car were not overwhelmingly debt-producing for you.
And that's precisely why our government, why Bush encouraged us to be good little consumers after 9/11.
Yeah.
Right? They want us to be good little consumers where we rack up all kinds of credit card debt. So we have this pressure, this kind of like this pressure to conform and not rock the boat too much. Because if we rock the boat too much, if we gather too much attention and we focus that attention on these people who are really screwing things up in the United States, then we lose our job, right? So they want us in debt. That's the trap. That's the economic trap. And the key to living free is not being in debt.
Well, when I got out of, now people would say, God, this guy's nuts. I lived at home till I was 32. But it's not living. I got a grad school, but you know, and maybe I was 31. But I paid rent. I had my room. I came and went as I went. My mom was cool with that. And on weekends, I remodeled houses. And for a long time, I worked truck docks on the weekends. But I wanted to be that. On any given day, I couldn't tell a guy take this job and shove it.
Yeah.
I never wanted. You know, when I finally bought a house, I paid most of it. I was on the trading floor and stuff. And then all of a sudden, I said, okay, I'm moving on. I bought a house and did. But it was, I never wanted to be in debt. I never wanted to be anything like that. You know, now, of course, if I'd have gotten married at 24 and had two and three kids and got a big mortgage, my independence would have been compromised. I'll use that term.
Right? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
That's why they want us in debt, though.
Yeah. Oh, if you're in debt, you're something. We have to play it. We have to find Ricardo. Find it. But another day older and deeper in debt, I owe my soul to the company store, Tennessee Ernie Ford. I mean, that was true, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yep.
I can't die. I owe the company money. Okay, then. SP Futures up 16. NASDAQ is up 62. We're going to try and make another rally today. See if we do it. Got the debates tonight. We got CPI tomorrow. Huge week on Stocks and Jacks. Hal, thank you. Cardo, nice job as usual. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.